For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood. And with help from Dominic Gribben of Hachette, Paul Stark of Orion, and Lynn Livingston from the RNIB Talking Books Library, we present a Read On New Books Special. There are so many new books entering the RNIB Talking Books Library, it's hard to keep up. Plus, RNIB have partnered with many of the top audio publishers in the UK who have agreed to give us every new audiobook going forward, plus their back catalogue. So you can imagine that's a lot of books. So let's take a show to look at just a small handful of them. Now we've got Lynn Livingston, Collections Development Executive at RNIB Library, to tell us more. Lynn, what's been happening?
Oh, we've had some great news coming in over the past year. And actually, in the last 12 months, we have put over 3,600 books into the Talking Book Library. So we've been really busy. And many of those are thanks to Penguin Random House and HarperCollins, but also Faber & Faber, Simon & Schuster and Princeton University Press. And then towards the end of last year, we had some really amazing things happen. We've been working towards securing agreements with other publishers for some time. And then one by one, they just came to fruition. And the first was Hachette UK. Now, this comprises Hodder, Headline, Quercus, Orion and Little Brown and all of their imprints. And we now get 15 books a week from them, which means a large selection of all the customer requests, which I've been collecting for some time, is actually slowly being fulfilled. They're coming into the library now. And we have the most amazing titles coming in. Really, really big names like Peter May and Stephen King, Stephen Leather, Victoria Hislop, Ellie Griffiths and Quentin Jardine. And these are big bestseller type books from all the major genres. And then the next thing that happened was we signed off with DK Audio. Now, you might know DK better as Dorling Kindersley, and they produce lots of fabulous non-fiction books. And this agreement was about 3 years in the making, but honestly, what an outcome. They agreed to give us their entire back catalogue and everything they publish from now on, which means that we now have tons of great educational books for kids to help with their schoolwork, but also they cover so many non-fiction topics for adults. And I mean, everything from gardening books to science and history to true crime. So there is literally something in there for everybody.
Now, that's already thousands of books, but that's not all.
No, there's even one more fantastic piece of news. And it was our final big achievement for the year. And that was to get Bloomsbury Publishing, and they agreed to give us their entire audio catalogue, and that's both the back catalogue and all the books going forward. And Bloomsbury produce such great quality books. They're often award winners, like Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, which won the Women's Prize for Fiction. There was also last year's Carnegie winner, October October, by Katja Balin. Also, this year's Carnegie shortlisted book, Medusa, by Jesse Burton, and also former Booker Prize shortlisted No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood, and so many more. We have such respected authors coming in, like William Dalrymple, Isabella Lendy, Colum McCann, but as well as all the great literary fiction within the collection, we've also got books on sport, on society, music, biographies, history, you name the category, there will be a book in it. So there is something for everybody. And you know that you're assured of really great quality writing on whatever subject you're reading.
So there is a bit of a queue for these books to be deified and put into the RNIB library.
Well, you know, we've got a really great process. So what happens is the publishers send us the audio files and then we run it through our own process to turn them into Daisy books. And then we actually meet them live. And we meet them live as close to the publication date as possible. We are a small team, so there's an awful lot of work involved. And we do our best to try and get them in on the date, but sometimes we're a little bit afterwards. But we are continually working to get really great content into the library. And we're actually putting about 300 books into the Talking Book Library every month now. So it's just a question of keeping up with that flood of books. But, you know, it's a brilliant problem to have.
And going forward, Lynn, you'll be joining us on Read On to tell us some of your favourite books that are entering the library.
It is. Do you know, there's so many books coming in, and we just want to shout about it a little bit, because, as I said, 300 books a month, you're going to miss some real treasures in there if we don't tell you about them. So I'm going to be coming on every week just to do a little bit of shouting about some great titles.
So here's Lynn's first roundup of some great titles entering the RNIB Talking Books Library.
First up is I Will Find You by Harlan Coben, kindly donated by Penguin Random House. Harlan Coben is a great favourite among readers and Netflix watchers, so this is his latest.
I'm serving the fifth year of a life sentence for murdering my own child. Spoiler alert, I didn't do it. My son Matthew was 3 years old at the time of his brutal murder. He was the best thing in my life. And then he was gone, and I've been serving a life sentence ever since. Not metaphorically, or should I say, not just metaphorically. This would be a life sentence no matter what, even if I hadn't been arrested and tried and convicted. But in my case, in this case, my life sentence is both metaphorical and literal. How, you wonder, can I possibly be innocent?
David and Cheryl Burrows are living the dream. Married, a beautiful house in the suburbs, a 3-year-old son named Matthew. When tragedy strikes one night in the worst possible way, David awakes to find himself covered in blood, but not his own, his son's. And while he knows he did not murder his son, the overwhelming evidence against him puts him behind bars indefinitely. 5 years into his imprisonment, Cheryl's sister arrives and drops a bombshell. She's come with a photograph that a friend took on a vacation at a theme park. The boy in the background seems similar, and even though David realizes it can't be, he knows it is. It's Matthew, and he's still alive.
I don't know what to make of it. The photograph does indeed appear to have been taken at an amusement park. A woman, I wonder whether this is pretty funny Irene, smiles shyly at the camera. Two boys, probably the Longleys, are on either hip, neither looking at the camera. Someone in a Bugs Bunny costume is on the right, someone dressed like Batman is on the left. Irene looks a little put out, but in a fun way. I can almost imagine the scene. Good old pharmaceutical marketing Tom cheerily goading pretty funny Irene to pose. Pretty funny Irene, not really in the mood, but being a good sport, the two boys having none of it. We've all been there. There's a giant red roller coaster in the background. The sun is shining in the faces of the Longley family, which explains why they are squinting and slightly turning away. Rachel has her eyes on me. I lift my eyes toward hers. She keeps pressing the photograph up to the glass. Look closer, David. I stare at her another second or two, and then I let my gaze wander back to the photograph. This time, I see it immediately. A steel claw reaches into my chest and squeezes my heart. I can't breathe.
I Will Find You by Harlan Coben is read by Stephen Webber and lasts 10 hours, 17 minutes.
Next up, we have one of the nation's favourite historians with a biography on one of the nation's favourite writers. It's Agatha Christie, A Very Elusive Woman by Lucy Worsley, which was given to us by Hodder.
If the two ladies on the train had asked her name, she wouldn't even have said Agatha Christie. She'd have answered to Mrs. Mallowan, the name she'd taken from the archaeologist, 14 years younger than herself, to whom she'd made an impetuous marriage. If asked her profession, she'd have said she had none. When an official form required her to put down what she did, The woman who's estimated to have sold 2 billion copies always wrote, "Housewife." And despite her gigantic success, she retained her perspective as an outsider and onlooker. She sidestepped a world that tried to define her. In this book, I'd like to explore why Agatha Christie spent her life pretending to be ordinary, when in fact she was breaking boundaries. "Nobody in the world," she once said, "was more inadequate to act the heroine than I was." Her view was partly her own extreme modesty, but it also had much to do with the world into which she was born, with its imperatives about what women could and couldn't do. This is a biography with a historical bent, the life of a woman whose story intertwines with that of the 20th century.
Why did Agatha Christie spend her career pretending that she was just an ordinary housewife when clearly she wasn't? As Lucy Worsley says, she was thrillingly, scintillatingly modern. Her life was modern too. She went surfing in Hawaii, she loved fast cars, and she was intrigued by the new science of psychology which helped her through devastating mental illness. So why, despite all the evidence to the contrary, did Agatha present herself as a retiring Edwardian lady of leisure? She was born in 1890 into a world which had its own rules about what women could and couldn't do. Lucy Worsley's biography is not just of a massively internationally successful writer. It's also the story of a person who, despite the obstacles of class and gender, became an astonishingly successful working woman. Agatha's life is fascinating for its mysteries and its passion. With access to personal letters and papers that have rarely been seen, Lucy Worsley's biography is both authoritative and entertaining, and makes us realise what an extraordinary pioneer Agatha Christie was, truly a woman who wrote the 20th century.
Agatha shattered the 20th century's rules for women. Females of her generation and social class were supposed to be slender, earn nothing, blindly adore their numerous children, and constantly give themselves to others. The only one of these Agatha completely fulfilled is the last. She did give the best of herself, her industry, her creativity, her occasional genius to her readers. No wonder they still love her for it. These days, we don't need to put women on pedestals. And that means we have to face the fact that somewhere in the mass of contradictions making up Agatha Christie was a very dark heart. It's not just that she could dream up stories in which even children can kill. It's also that her work contains views on race and class that are unacceptable today. But that doesn't mean we should tut-tut and look away. This matters, because Agatha Christie's writing has become a sort of shorthand for a typically English view of the world. The prejudices of her class and time, often revealed in her fiction, are part of the history of 20th century Britain.
Agatha Christie by Lucy Worsley is read by the author and runs for 13 hours and 46 minutes.
We've been asked by so many of our readers to finish off the Ellie Griffiths, Dr. Ruth Galloway crime series. So, thanks to donations from Quercus and the Hachette Group, we have done just that with the last 6 books in the series. Here's the first of those 6, number 10, which is The Dark Angel.
Angelo Morelli. Ruth remembers a conference 12 years ago. A hotel in Rome, looking out on Trastevere. Terracotta rooftops, vespers roaring over the cobbles, a flood-lit fountain. Ruth had just split up with her live-in boyfriend, Peter, and had been giddy with freedom and with the miracle of having wrested this overseas trip from under Phil's nose. Angelo was an archaeologist from Rome University, an expert on the Romans. He had studied in America, she remembered, and spoke perfect English, though with that heartbreakingly sexy accent. And one evening, after a seminar on the Etruscans, the fountains and the frescoes had got too much for them, and they'd ended up in bed. It had only been one night, and Ruth remembered that in the morning she hadn't even felt embarrassed. They'd had a civilised breakfast in the Piazza di Santa Maria and gone on to a lecture on dating ceramics. She didn't even know if Angelo had a girlfriend or not. He hadn't been married, though. She'd checked that much. She had always vowed never to sleep with a married man. Until she met Nelson, and all the rules changed.
Dr. Ruth Galloway is flattered when she receives a letter from Italian archaeologist Dr. Angelo Marelli asking for her help. He's discovered a group of bones in a tiny hilltop village near Rome, but doesn't know what to make of them. It's years since Ruth has had a holiday, and even a working holiday to Italy is very welcome. So Ruth travels to Castello degli Angeli, accompanied by her daughter Kate and friend Shona. In the town, she finds a baffling Roman mystery and a dark secret involving the war years and the resistance. To her amazement, she also soon finds Harry Nelson with Cathbad in tow. But there is no time to overcome their mutual shock. The ancient bones spark a modern murder, and Ruth must discover what secrets there are in Castello degli Angeli that someone would kill to protect.
Formia turns out to be perfect. At first, Ruth is quite worried as Angelo drives them past ancient walls and a rocky harbour. This was a famous port in Roman times, he tells them. Formia is from the Greek word for landing place. It was a fashionable resort even then. That's as maybe, thinks Ruth, but the children want sand and shallow water and ice creams. She stares moodily at the harbour with its multicoloured boats and picturesque tower. A huge grey shape that looks like a warship looms in the background. Cicero was assassinated outside the town in 43 BCE, Angelo is saying. There is a monument to him here. And after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, the town was sacked by the barbarians. Louis starts to whine softly, like a plane coming into land. But as Angelo drives along what he calls the Lungomare, the rocks give way to sand and colourful umbrellas, and families carrying beach towels. Kate and Louis perk up and start singing, Old MacDonald Had a Beach. Life's a beach, mutters Ruth.
The Dark Angel by Ellie Griffiths, book 10 in the Ruth Galloway series, is read by Jane McDowell and lasts 9 hours 53 minutes.
And lastly, we have the award-winning The Dutch House by Anne Patchett, which our readers finally have in the library thanks to Bloomsbury. And it's narrated by the wonderful Tom Hanks.
The first time my father brought Andrea to the Dutch house, Sandy, our housekeeper, came to my sister's room and told us to come downstairs. Your father has a friend he wants you to meet, she said. Is it a work friend? Maeve asked. She was older and so had a more complex understanding of friendship. Sandy considered the question. I'd say not. Where's your brother? Window seat, Maeve said. Sandy had to pull the draperies back to find me. Why do you have to close the drapes? I was reading. Privacy, I said. Though at 8, I had no notion of privacy. I liked the word, and I liked the boxed-in feel the draperies gave when they were closed. As for the visitor, it was a mystery. Our father didn't have friends, at least not the kind who came to the house late on a Saturday afternoon. I left my secret spot and went to the top of the stairs to lie down on the rug that covered the landing. I knew from experience I could see into the drawing room by looking between the newel post and the first baluster if I was on the floor. There was our father in front of the fireplace with a woman, and from what I could tell, they were studying the portraits of Mr. and Mrs. Vanubeek. I got up and went back to my sister's room to make my report.
Danny Conroy grows up in the Dutch House, a lavish folly in small-town Pennsylvania, taken on by his property developer father. Though his father is distant and his mother is absent, Danny has his beloved sister, Maeve. Maeve, with her wall of black hair, her delicacy, her brilliance. Life is comfortable and coherent, played out under the watchful eyes of the house's former owners in the frames of their oil paintings, or under the cover of the draperies around the window seat in Maeve's room. Then one day their father brings Andrea home. Andrea, small and neat, a dark hat no bigger than a saucer pinned over a twist of her fair hair.
"It's a woman," I said to Maeve. Sandy would have known this already. Sandy asked me if I'd brushed my teeth, by which she meant, had I brushed them that morning? No one brushed their teeth at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Sandy had to do everything herself because Jocelyn had Saturdays off. Sandy would have laid the fire and answered the door and offered drinks, and on top of all that, was now responsible for my teeth. Sandy was off Mondays. Sandy and Jocelyn were both off Sundays because my father didn't think people should be made to work on Sundays. "I did," I said, because I probably had. "Do it again," she said, "and brush your hair." The last part she meant for my sister, whose hair was long and black and as thick as 10 horsetails tied together. No amount of brushing had ever made it look brushed. Once we were deemed presentable, Maeve and I went downstairs and stood beneath the wide archway of the foyer, watching our father and Andrea watch the Van Hoobakes. They didn't notice us, or they didn't acknowledge us, hard to say, and so we waited.
The Dutch House by Anne Patchett is read by Tom Hanks and runs for 9 hours 53 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, "Alexa, call RNIB helpline" for more information. RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books, and we're having a new books special. Now let's dive into a new partnership between RNIB and Hachette. RNIB have received hundreds of new books that will be available to lend to people with sight loss. Hachette UK is donating the audiobooks to RNIB and will make a selection available to RNIB Reading Services customers each month, substantially increasing the library's collection. Joining me from Hachette, one of the audio publishers, Dominic Gribben. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks Robert. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the partnership.
So effectively the partnership is something that it aligns with Hachette's stated mission to basically open up new worlds of ideas, learning, entertainment and opportunity to as many people as possible. We've been working with the RNIB for quite a long time, but we just felt as a group that there was more that we could be doing. So that's what drove us to sort of put this partnership in place.
Now, there are lots of divisions within Hachette. So let's look at some of the books. There may be more coming in the next few weeks, but let's have a listen to, say, a selection of four books that will be coming soon. What one have you picked first?
So first up, there is a book called The Escape Artist by Jonathan Friedland. This is a non-fiction account of a man called Rudolf Werber, who was an escapee from the Auschwitz concentration camp. Rudy escaped with one of his fellow inmates and effectively traveled across Europe to reach safety in France and to there basically tell the world through a recorded interview that was then disseminated around to the various different world leaders what was happening and break in the story of the Holocaust. So it's an incredible an incredible story told in an incredibly engaging way by journalist Jonathan Friedland, who writes for The Guardian, who's also a novelist in his own right. So it's a really gripping story, but a true one. It's a fantastic listen, read by Jonathan himself.
After days of delay, weeks of obsessive preparation, months of watching the failed attempts of others, and 2 years of seeing the depths to which human beings could sink, the moment had finally come. It was time to escape. The two other prisoners were already there at the designated spot. Wordlessly, they gave the nod. Do it now. Walter and Fred didn't hesitate. They climbed on top of the timbers, found the opening, and, one after the other, they dropped inside. A second later, their comrades moved the planks into place above their heads. One of them whispered, "Bon voyage!" And then all was dark and silent. Without delay, Walter set to work. He pulled out the machorka, the cheap Soviet tobacco he had been told about, a batch that had been prepared as instructed, soaked in petrol and dried. Slowly, he began to wedge it into the cracks between the wooden boards, sometimes blowing on it gently, puffing it into place, hoping against hope that the Soviet prisoner of war who had taught him the trick was right, that the scent would be repellent to dogs. Not that they were relying solely on Walter's handiwork. They'd already made sure that the ground around the hideout was liberally sprinkled with the treated tobacco, so that the canine SS would not even draw near. If the Red Army man's confidence was well-founded, Walter and Fred should be able to crouch in this hole beneath the woodpile, silent and undisturbed, for exactly as long as they needed, 3 days and three nights.
As the escape artist, the man who broke out of Auschwitz to warn the world, written and read by Jonathan Friedland. Now, moving from non-fiction to fiction.
So my next selection is by one of Quirkus's biggest authors, Peter May, a fellow Scot like yourself. Peter is an author of just really, really gripping thrillers, one of the best in the business. And from an audiobook, from a listener perspective, he's one of those authors who has a kind of a partnership with the guy who narrates his audiobooks, Peter Forbes. The two Peters are made for each other, and something we often see in the listener reviews of his books is that if it's Peter May, read by Peter Forbes, I'm in. Peter writes a number of series, but A Silent Death is one of his standalones. He's been doing more of those recently. So for someone who would like to just investigate and try Peter May, there's no better place to start than this one.
Finally, reluctantly, he set off along the concourse himself. He had not anticipated having to clear passport control, remaining airside and never officially entering Spain. But in the absence of any information to the contrary, he joined the queue at international arrivals and took out his iPhone. To his annoyance, he found that it was not yet logged into the local server. He could not even call London to clarify his situation. He sighed his frustration and felt his blood pressure rising. Why was it that people were incapable of making plans and sticking to them? He supposed that maybe someone might be waiting for him beyond passport control, but if so, why had he not been told? It was a further 10 minutes before he was siphoned off with others from the lengthening queue for the automatic passport readers and invited across a white line to face an immigration officer who glared at him through a glass screen. Mackenzie slipped his passport through the hatch and glared back. An electronic reader below the counter scanned his biometric details before his passport was pushed back at him, and a flick of the head welcomed him to Spain. There was no one waiting to greet him on the other side, no one raising a card with Mackenzie scrawled on it. Mackenzie was at a loss. He checked his phone and saw with relief that he now had a signal. He dialed the NCA and listened to it ringing 2,000 miles away.
National Crime Agency, how may I help you?
This is Investigator John Mackenzie. Could you put me through to Director Beard?
The director is not here today.
You must have an emergency number for him.
Is this an emergency?
No, I want to wish him happy birthday. Of course it's a f***ing emergency. He closed his eyes and cursed himself for swearing.
One moment. not a hint in the voice at the other end that his sarcasm had even registered. Mackenzie sighed again. Why bother asking him to wait one moment when they both knew it was going to be much longer than that? In fact, it was almost 3 minutes before the operator got back to him.
I'm sorry, Director Beard is not contactable right now. Can I take a message?
Mackenzie fought to control his anger. Tell him that John Mackenzie called and that it is very important he call me back as soon as possible. He returned the phone to his shirt pocket and looked about him, at a loss for what to do now. This was not going well.
That's A Silent Death by Peter May, as read by Peter Forbes, available soon from RNIB Talking Books. Now, let's go to perhaps one of the biggest authors that we have in the RNIB Talking Books library.
Yeah, so next up is Stephen King's latest fairy tale. King is one of those authors that just keeps on going. I think we have close to 100 books now on the Hodder list, and he's been part of Hodder's kind of publishing family for 40 odd years now. Fairy Tale for me is one of my personal sort of recent favorites of his. It's a story of a young boy, Charlie Reed, who is just, you know, a regular kid. He's good at pretty much everything at school. He's a good guy as well. And he finds himself developing this relationship with his crotchety hermit-like neighbor, Mr. Bowditch. But eventually he kind of cracks through Bowditch's frosty exterior and they become fast friends. But when things sort of take a turn for the worse in terms of Bowditch's health, and Charlie has to help him around the house a bit more, he soon discovers that there's something odd going on in Bowditch's shed. Before you know it, we're into classic Stephen King territory with other worlds and fantastical goings on once you go through the keyhole of that shed. But it's a great story. It's phenomenally read by Seth Numerick, and it was an Audie Award winner for Best Fiction Performance at the award ceremony earlier in the year. So yeah, it's a cracker.
Stephen King also seems to be listed as a narrator in that book.
That's true. Some of King's regular listeners, or what he, as he would probably term them, constant listeners, they really rate King as a narrator. He has read some of his books in the past, which is an unusual enough thing for an author to read fiction. So he has a sort of a guest appearance in this one, which works quite nicely, actually.
We lived halfway up the long length of Sycamore Street Hill, about a quarter mile from the bridge. There was a little gas and convenience store on the other side called Zip Mart. It sold all the usual stuff, from motor oil to Wonder Bread to Little Debbie cakes, but it also sold fried chicken made by the proprietor, Mr. Eliadis, known to the neighborhood as Mr. Zippy. That chicken was exactly what the sign in the window said, the best in the land. I can still remember how tasty it was, but I never ate a single piece after my mom died. I would have gagged it up if I tried. One Saturday in November of 2003, the town council still discussing paving the bridge and still deciding it could wait another year, my mother told us she was going to walk down to the Zippy and get us fried chicken for dinner. My father and I were watching a college football game.
"You should take the car," Dad said. "It's going to rain."
"I need the exercise," Mom said. "But I'll wear my Little Red Riding Hood raincoat." And that's what she was wearing the last time I saw her. The hood wasn't up because it wasn't raining yet, so her hair was spilling over her shoulders. I was 7 years old and thought my mother had the world's most beautiful red hair. She saw me looking at her through the window and waved. I waved back, then turned my attention to the TV, where LSU was driving. I wish I had looked longer, but I don't blame myself. You never know where the trap doors are in your life, do you? It wasn't my fault, and it wasn't Dad's fault, although I know he blamed himself. Thought, if only I'd gotten up off my dead ass and given her a ride to the damn store. It probably wasn't the fault of the man in the plumbing truck, either. The cop said he was sober, and he swore he was keeping to the speed limit, which was 25 in our residential zone. Dad said that even if that were true, the man must have taken his eyes off the road, if only for a few seconds. Dad was probably right about that. He was an insurance claims adjuster, and he told me once that the only pure accident he ever heard of was a man in Arizona who was killed when a meteor hit him in the head.
There's always someone at fault, Dad said, which is not the same as blame.
Do you blame the man who hit Mom? I asked. He thought about it, raised his glass to his lips, and drank. This was 6 or 8 months after Mom died, and he'd pretty much given up on beer. By then, he was strictly a Gilby's man.
I try not to. And mostly I can do that unless I wake up at 2 in the morning with nobody in the bed but me. Then I blame him.
Seth Numrick's reading from Fairy Tale by Stephen King. And the final book we'll look at today is a bit closer to home.
Yes, so final book that I wanted to flag today is The Marriage Portrait by Maggie O'Farrell, one of the stars of the headline Tinder press list. Maggie obviously had a huge success a few years ago now with Hamnet, her first foray into fictionalized historical biography. This one is very much in that territory again and follows the story of Lucrezia de' Medici and effectively the story of her life in Italy during the 1500s. Maggie's an incredible author and she really kind of gets into the heads of her characters. And this one is, again, it's a real treat for audiobook listeners. Genevieve Gaunt, who I don't think has read too many audiobooks in the past, but I'll just read out the strapline actually from Audiophile magazine in the US. Three talented women, narrator, author, and protagonist, combine forces for this gripping historical novel set in Renaissance Italy. I don't think I can sum it up much better than that.
And perhaps tomorrow, her husband is saying, as he tips his bowl to scoop out the final dregs of soup, we shall go for a ride along the river. The views further west are most pleasing to the eye. I will see to it that your saddle is adjusted. I noticed today that it was listing on one side, and the hooves of your mare will need attention, I fear, when we return, and... The sense of his words disintegrates as Lucrezia stares at him, until what comes from his mouth reaches her as a string of babble and nonsense, the squawks of a beast. Why is he saying these things? How can he sit there, serenely eating his food, talking about groomsmen and horse tack, when somewhere in his mind lurks a scheme to end her life? Once again, Lucrezia seems to hear the rasping voice of his sister, Elisabetta, saying into her ear, "You have no idea what he is capable of." Despite the fire that growls and pops in the large grate, despite the breath that comes from her, from her husband, from the servants in the shadows, the air in the dining hall is as frigid as iron. It has been an unusually chill winter, which yet shows no sign of ending. Even the candles, standing in ornate brass holders, seem to shiver, casting an uncertain light that doesn't reach the walls. Her husband's face comes in and out of visibility. She watches with fixed fascination, as his expression changes with every flicker of the candle, first thoughtful, then kind, now stern, now animated, now forbidding, now handsome, then amorous, and then detached. It is true. She has no idea what he is capable of, and she does not want to find out.
Genevieve Gaunt, reading from Maggie O'Farrell's The Marriage Portrait. So Dominic Gribben, audio publisher at Hachette, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
And we'll hear about some more new books after this.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love. And people doing things in the world, you just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think talking books is the best thing ever.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio.
Joining me now is Paul Stark, Senior Audio Manager with the Orion Publishing Group. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good and very happy about this collaboration between Hachette/Orion and RNIB. Tell us about the relationship we now have.
So the relationship we now have is aimed around making sure as many Orion and Hachette UK audiobooks are available to RNIB members as possible. I'm sure it's much more complicated than that, but it's all about making sure that the recordings that we're producing are available in accessible formats and to library members, just so that as many people as possible can listen to them.
Now, as we said, that Orion's part of Hachette, but what makes Orion different?
So kind of at the heart of everything we do is our mission statement that every story matters. And we're really dedicated to breadth of publishing, breadth of voices, you know, really pushing at the boundaries of storytelling, both from a fiction and nonfiction perspective. So I like to think that the productions we work on and the books that we publish, both in audio and in print and ebook, really are aimed at starting conversations and just reflecting the breadth of culture in the UK and further afield.
I know none of the books we're talking about today are of this genre, but I associate Orion, or at least I did, with science fiction.
Yes. Well, I'd say Ben Aronovich definitely fits into that category. There's definitely a magical element there. And yeah, our Gallant's List, I would argue, is second to none. I mean, it's one of the big reasons why I joined Orion, and I've been here for 16 years now. I grew up reading books about dragons. You know, I remember my dad telling me Arthurian myths when I was little, and then I discovered Terry Pratchett and Anne McCaffrey and Ursula Le Guin. So I love kind of working on that side of things. And we've got a real range of science fiction and fantasy authors that I'm incredibly proud to work with, and some really exciting ones coming up in 2023 and onwards.
So let's look at some books that will be coming from Orion to the RNIB Talking Books Library. And the first one, we're looking at The Sunrise Sisterhood.
Yeah, so this is the new book coming from Kathy Bramley this summer. Kathy's a wonderful writer. I mean, there's such warmth and such a sense of community in what she writes, and her characters and dialogue is just absolutely fantastic. This book is set in Solcombe in the southwest, and it's about a woman whose best friend and business partner has passed away, and kind of the challenge she then faces with her godchildren to kind of save the business that they established together. And it's really warm and heartfelt, and I just love reading and listening to Kathy's books. Kathy's also a real advocate for the RNIB. She loves making sure that her audio editions are available as widely as possible. So I know she'll be really pleased to hear that this is going into the RNIB library.
Liz had started the morning with a brief phone call to Claire, Jen's daughter, who, as usual, was racing to get the baby fed and dressed and out of the door for work and nursery. They'd only spoken for a minute or so, but it was long enough for Liz to let her know she was thinking about her and what she knew would be a tough day, and for her to connect with someone who had loved Jen too. Her plan had been to catch the ferry and walk to the Garra Rock Hotel, Jen's favourite place, to toast her best friend with a glass of champagne. But Jen's ex-husband, Mike, had phoned this morning and invited her for an impromptu lunch. It had been so thoughtful of him, and she'd accepted without hesitation. "Hey, did Mum tell you she's dating again?" Noah said, collecting the wine list from the table. Liz raised her eyebrows in surprise. Viv must only have been divorced a matter of months after kicking her husband out for cheating on her last year. Good for her. Anyone special? The sun was getting stronger, and she shaded her eyes as she looked up at Noah. He grinned. "She's got a few on the go. I don't think she's too fussed about getting tied down again. She's got a better social life than me these days. Now I'm working full-time here, I hardly get to see my girlfriend." "Who's the lucky girl?" "Jade, manager of the coffee shop at the other end of 4th Street." "I know the one," Liz nodded, although not being much of a coffee drinker herself, she'd never been in. Jen had been a coffee fiend, as was Claire, so she always kept the good stuff in, had a proper machine and everything. "I'll go and get that wine," said Noah.
That's Leslie Sharp, reading from The Sunrise Sisterhood by Kathy Bramley. Let's move on to Amongst Our Weapons.
Yes, so this is the latest in the Rivers of London series by Ben Aronovich, a series that starts with Rivers of London. They've all been read by the fantastic Cobner Holbrook-Smith, who you may have seen in films like Paddington 2 and Mary Poppins Returns. And the basic principle of this is that Harry Potter grows up and joins the police force. So they're all set in London. They build on the kind of the history and the heritage and the kind of the multicultural fabric that London is built on. But then there's magic elements as well. You've got the personifications of rivers and vampires and kind of spirits. And they're just absolutely fantastic books. They're really very funny, very clever, really heartfelt at times as well. And, you know, kind of at the core of it, we've got a real connection between Ben Aronovich, the author, and Cobner Holbrook-Smith as the voice of the books and voice of Peter Grant. They've been working together for years now. And Ben, I know, writes the series with Cobner in mind. And I think you can really hear that connection in the recording. I love these books. I could just can never wait to listen to them.
Gleed waved us over to a storage box, half filled with packets of paper noddy suits. She was already kitted out with her hood up, drawn tight so that she could keep her expensive hijab tucked away in her jacket. We shed our coats and struggled into our suits and gloves, and I had to rifle through the cellophane-wrapped packets to find one in XXL size. You nearly always have to go one size up to fit them over your street clothes, and if you're late to a scene, you can end up squeaking round in something too small. As we wrestled our way into our suits, Gleed filled us in.
Just after 9 o'clock this morning, an unidentified white male entered the vault, made his way down here, then proceeded to one of the shops and threatened the proprietor. The proprietor hit the silent alarm, but before anyone could respond, something happened. We don't know what. And the male was killed.
Something happened? I said.
Want to guess how much CCTV there is in this place?
Asked Gleed.
Want to guess how much of it is still working?
Strong magic damages microprocessors. One of the telltale signs of a Falcon event tends to be the local CCTV getting knocked out. Us police like our CCTV. It makes our job easier. And our only complaint about the surveillance state is that it's not nearly as seamless as everyone seems to think it is. Just ask anyone who's had to sit through 500 hours of grainy video on the off chance someone in a hoodie looked the wrong way at the right moment. Once we were kitted out and as anonymous as stormtroopers, we waddled off to see just what something had happened to our victim.
That's Cobner Holbrook-Smith reading Ben Aronovich's Amongst Our Weapons, the brand new book in the Rivers of London series. Now, from fiction to non-fiction, biography, and biography read by quite a large cast.
Yes. Yes, so this is Let's Do It, which is an authorised biography of just the incomparable Victoria Wood. And I think this is one of the books I've been most proud to work on during my time at Orion. The book was written with kind of the collaboration of Victoria Wood's family and estate by Jasper Rees. And we knew we wanted to do something really special with the audiobook. So we brought in a host of people who'd worked with Victoria through her career, including people like Celia Imlay and Julie Waters. And we've really made the audiobook kind of the ultimate tribute to her and her career. And it also includes a few little music snippets as well, kind of previously unreleased recordings. So I just love the kind of the passion and the warmth that all of the individual readers have brought to the recording.
House on the Edge, read by Julie Walters. At the top of Castle Hill Road, you turn left and just follow the road for about a mile. It becomes more of a track as it goes on, and my house is opposite the golf course and is, or was, a double-fronted bungalow in a very big garden with fields behind. Directions to Television Researcher, 1996. When she entered her teens, Victoria was given a handsome photograph album. Vicky Wood, she wrote on the opening page. May 19th, 1966, aged 13. Below is a snap of Birtle Edge House, where she had lived for the previous 8 years. Our house, She captioned it in red capitals, and above she added a parenthesis, "Where it all happened." What exactly did happen at Birtle? On the one hand, almost everything that went into forming her. On the other, almost nothing. Victoria would characterise it as a prefab on steroids. Helen first spotted an advertisement in the Berry Times for a former children's holiday home overlooking the Rossendale Valley. Stanley did not share her enthusiasm, put off by the price, but also its poor state of repair. It was built in 1908 as a rural bolt hole for Berry's disadvantaged children. Among the more recent occupants had been Polish refugees during the war. A handsome red brick exterior with elegant original features had long since been protected from the elements by cement render. The house had no electricity or running water and no sewage system, and being a bungalow, its expanse of roof was in constant need of fixing. The same went for the wind-buffeted windows. The courtyard had a delicately canopied colonnade, inserted by an architect who took an optimistic view of the house's situation. Stanley succumbed and secured a private mortgage from a member of the Liberal Party. For several months, the Woods took on the project of renovating their next home. They would all troop up at weekends, occasionally staying overnight. Stanley donned overalls, in which he would be seen for years to come, to clamber up a ladder and apply another layer of cheap waterproof cement paint. Inside, every light had to be drawn down on a chain and lit, a fiddly process because the delicate gas mantles broke to the touch. The water was pumped from the farm half a mile away. The septic tank, which smelled in summer, meant they had to be careful about what they flushed into the system. Walls were often being knocked down or windows boarded up. "It was a wreck," says Rosalind. "It put a terrific strain on them. They didn't have the money to do it up properly. They tried to do it piecemeal as they went along, and neither of them had the temperament or the know-how to pull it off. It was too big and too isolated and cold and damp and uncomfortable and drafty."
That's one of the many voices, including Julie Walters, Celia Imrie, Duncan Preston, Susie Blake, and many more, reading from Let's Do It, the authorised biography of Victoria Wood by Jasper Rees. Now, finally, let's end on a thriller.
Yes, and Sharon Bolton is a fantastic thriller writer, and The Pact is you know, a real, for me, one of her real standout books. It's based around a group of friends in Oxford, kind of they're right at that age where they're leaving school, getting ready to go to university. And they're living this kind of one last carefree summer before they go their separate ways. And they've all been kind of taken in turns to kind of go through this rite of passage where they drive the wrong way as fast as they can down a major motorway. And the last one of the group is doing it, and something goes horribly wrong, and the police get involved, and one of the group steps forward and agrees to take the fall on behalf of all of them. And then the action cuts forward, so they're all adults, they've all become successful in their different ways, and their friend is now coming out of prison and looking to settle a few scores. It's really chilling, it's clever, it's twisty, you know. Sharon Bolton never disappoints, and I love this book.
It was 3 o'clock in the morning the first time. Felix had been at the wheel, of course he had, and they'd seen no other cars. It had taken a little over 2 minutes because Felix drove like a maniac down the centre lane. After the first minute had passed, when none of them spoke, when they'd all stared wide-eyed and open-mouthed into the darkness, the A40 had morphed into the M40. They'd sped another mile before Felix had braked hard, swinging the car round in a 330-degree turn to reach the exit slip road of Junction 7. 2 minutes of stupid, senseless risk, and they were back on the right side of the law. The car, Felix's mother's VW Golf Cabriolet, had erupted with a loud, jubilant noise. They'd laughed, screamed, and hugged each other. None of them had ever felt more alive. They didn't sleep that night. They drank and talked till dawn and beyond. There wasn't a drug that could compare to it. They knew they'd never feel that way again as long as they lived. It had been a rite of passage. They'd bet against the odds and won. They were marked. Special. But even the purest high wears off. And it had only been a matter of time before Zav had wanted to do it too. Zav hadn't been quite so lucky as Felix. As he'd reached the M40, at a little over 80 miles an hour, Felix, who'd been in the passenger seat, had seen the taillights of a car on the opposite carriageway. It was a little way ahead of them, but they were gaining on it. "Stop the car! Turn around!" Amber had shrieked. "No, slow down. They might think we're behind them, on a bend in the road," Daniel said. "Kill your lights. They won't see us." Felix leaned across the driver's seat and switched off the headlights. The night was dark, cloud cover and no moon. They were speeding into a black void. Amber screamed and Zav switched the lights back on and floored the accelerator. The speedometer crept up to 85 miles an hour, 90, 92. Zav leaned forward over the wheel, as though willing the car to go faster.
That's Hanako Footman reading from Sharon Bolton's The Pact, a gripping summer thriller with mind-bending twists and suspense. And Paul Stark, Senior Audio Manager with the Orion Publishing Group, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Every book you've heard on today's edition of Read On is available commercially and available free from the RNIB Library. For more information, call 0303 123 9999 or visit rniblibrary.com. That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.